Welcome to TWIL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on September 24th, 2015. I am Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law.
And Frank, today we welcome Scott Burris. Scott is professor of law at Temple Law School, where he directs the Center for Health Law, Policy and Practice, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Research on Policy and Law program. Scott is also a professor in Temple School of Public Health. Scott, one of the things I didn't include in your quick bio there was that you direct PHLR, the Public Health Law Research, which is a national program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And at least some of the work of PHLR, and Scott, I hope this label is appropriate, I think is sort of meta. It looks at trends in public health laws around the country, as well as sort of building an analytic framework to look at them. If you agree with that description, could you tell us a little bit more about this sort of how you look at public health laws in the states and their trends, and maybe give us some examples to get us rolling today.
Oh my gosh, three law professors, and you start with the concept that I will agree? No one's going to. There's not going to be any agreement here. Just on principle, we can't agree. But it's a roughly accurate description, let me put it that way. But I'll fill in a little bit of the nuance on that point. The Public Health Law Research Program was funded to support the building of a field of empirical research on the health impacts of law and legal practices. And so in addition to actually funding people to do that kind of research, we also tried to build tools, methods, tools, and other kinds of tools that would help people do that kind of research better. One of the things that we worked on first as a methods project and then as a tools project was, all right, hold on, I'm just getting like terrible static here. Are you getting that too? Okay, it was deafening static. But I will 2-3-1 ignore the static as long as it's not coming through on your end. Okay, so one of the things that we did in PHLR as first a methods and then a tools project was to look at how we create legal data for evaluation research purposes, for quantitative research. So, you know, if you're going to do a study of seatbelt laws or you're going to do a study of youth concussion laws as they vary across the states, you're going to have to actually have a data set that captures the key attributes of that law, not just whether somebody has a law or not, which usually doesn't give you enough variation and misses key differences. You actually want to code the detailed characteristics of those laws. And it turns out that although there had been a lot of experience in doing that kind of work, there had been very little methodological literature developed. And so we took the little bit that had been there and some of the people who were expert at creating legal data sets and asked them to write a paper and evaluation review about sort of best practices in coding, collecting and coding legal data for accuracy and validity. Once we had that paper in hand and were starting to spread the word about how to do that, we realized, well, we ought to probably try it ourselves and see if we can make some legal data sets so we can, you know, in the old standards, you know, watch one, do one, teach one. So we started to code a data set on distracted driving laws, which were becoming very popular at that time, laws about using cell phones and texting and so on. We quickly realized that there was no software that was ideal for doing this kind of work. Ideally, in a good scientific process, there's redundant coding that's going on at a certain level to make sure that we individual coders are getting it right and that we properly understand and apply our coding scheme. And then all that stuff's got to be compared and joined. And so you get to all these problems that current software didn't really deal with very well. So we, being a funded program with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, had the resources to get a developer to build us some software. And then when we had all this digitized legal data in our databases that we built, we realized, well, wait a minute, we can publish this stuff too. You know, we can make this public because it's all in electronic form now, and making web pages is easy these days. So we built a second piece of the software to display the data, and that was the birth of Law Atlas, the website where we track health policy across time and space. And that's, you know, what you're referring to, that meta piece. It's for us, it serves first the primary purpose of creating data to encourage people to do the evaluation research. But we also realized it does a bunch of other cool things. I mean, obviously, it makes legal information much more readily available to non-lawyers, because you could just go in and find the law you're interested in and then interact with it, ask questions about what it does, compare it across the states, and over time, you can look at the law very easily. We include all that stuff there. But another thing it does is create the possibility of I guess we could say, transparency and accountability in the world of health policy recommendations. So if the feds say, for example, as they do in Healthy People 2020, every state ought to have a bicycle helmet law. You know, what you don't see them doing is saying, and when we made this recommendation, this is how many states had it, and since then, this is how many states have added such a law. That just never happens. And although that's common in other kinds of recommendations, we really don't have it systematically tracked. Health law recommendations, and our policy surveillance process makes that possible, which I think is really important for helping us do a better job in spreading things that work.
Do you have to sort of take the initiative on all of these, or are you able to sort of get data from other sort of major players like the CDC or something like that? Or I guess if In the space that I tend to work in, which often intersects with state licensing laws, scope of practice laws, I'll go to FSMB and see what they've got up. So, I mean, are you having to do an awful lot of this from scratch, or is there stuff you can leverage?
Well, we've stumbled into this, you might say, learning how to do it and then starting to think about how to systematize it and spread it. Over the last few years. So when we started out, we picked interesting topics that nobody else had done, and we did it ourselves. Then we started to have grantees who would build data. So for example, we have a great data set on state OSHA laws made by Public Citizen. CDC has also gotten interested, and so we have data sets that are funded by CDC and some that have been built by CDC on the pages. But when you start to think about the whole universe of legal information and where it resides, you get into a much more complicated picture. We did a scan for CDC, and we're just working on finalizing that now, but suffice to say that we found something like 1,700 individual area legal data sets, you might say, or 50 state surveys of law somewhere on the web posted in the last 5 years. And I don't even think we found all of them. We had so many, we did a kind of abbreviated scan methodology. So there's a huge amount of effort that's going in from all sorts of organizations to do 50 state surveys of health laws and health regulations. The problem is that the quality varies tremendously. And I don't mean quality just on the dimension of accuracy. I expect actually that the accuracy is probably reasonably good. I mean quality in a broader sense. So on only a handful of these sites can you actually download data. So someone has done the work to go and do all this legal research and to identify specific attributes of the law, and they may have a PDF on their page, or they may have they may have a nice kind of HTML cool page that does neat things, but you can't download that data and put it into the world of other data very easily. You'd have to type it out, essentially. Another thing that happens is you don't know when they did it, and you don't know how up to date it is, because basic conventions like telling us when this information is valid are not followed regularly. You don't know how it was done. You know, what methods were used to find this, which, you know, we think of ourselves in law as having sort of a standardized legal research method, but the details are important. And without some kind of protocol or methods explanation, those data are much less likely to be used by scientists. And if they are used, they should kind of get kicked out in peer review, because, you know, just because it's law doesn't mean it should be free of the usual requirements of transparency and explicitness in methods. So, you know, one of the things that's happened in the last few months is that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has funded us for 3 years, separate from our Policies for Action program and separate from the Public Health Law Research Program, to conduct a 3-year program on encouraging wider use of policy surveillance, development of consensus standards on how to do that kind of research, and, you know, at least consensus views on how to make the data available. And we'll be we're just launching that now, but we'll be pushing in the next few years to try and have better answers to your question. You know, who's making this? How do they make it? Where can it be found? So that's pretty exciting.
This is a really exciting initiative, Scott. And, you know, now that I hear you describe the overall project, I just want to bring up a few things that have come up in my experience in the open data, big data policy community, and then just put a question to you about sort of the relevance of this, not just only to health lawyers, and I think it's quite relevant to us, but also to all sorts of legal scholars. And so my question, I guess, would be, I have been following, for example, in the financial world, the development of these standards for things called legal entity identifiers, which, you know, would essentially permit regulators to understand all of the contracts between all the different financial institutions and entities and sub-corporations. It's corporations and parents and subsidiaries and all of that. And it's almost as if they're trying to develop this map of the social world, just as we might have maps of the physical world or knowing all the species in an area or something. And I guess one of the first questions that comes to mind in thinking about the project and policy surveillance is the ultimate aspiration here to match policy surveillance to data about the state of the world in order to see whether certain policies have led to better outcomes? So, for example, is the ultimate goal of having the helmet law database in place to eventually match that up to, say, a database that would be the authoritative record of injuries suffered by those without helmets or something like that? Is that the direction it's going, or am I putting the cart before the horse or going too far there?
No, I think that you might say that's the end of the line, but you know, it's not the only value, even from the point of view of research and evaluation. The idea of policy surveillance, that term was coined, as far as I know, by two great health researchers from Chicago, Frank Chalupka and Jamie Chiriki. And their argument was essentially, in every other part of public health, we follow the mantra that what gets measured gets done. We understand that if a disease condition is important to us, we need to know where that disease is happening, in what populations, how fast it's spreading, is it growing or declining, and you know that kind of surveillance data ultimately can be used as an outcome measure for intervention research, but we also use it to guide resource allocation and to guide intermediate policy decisions and intervention decisions. And so it's sort of the same thing here. You know, ultimately, if we have data on how the law has changed over space and time, we have, you know, half of what we need in terms of data to study the impact, a third, let's say, conceptually. You know, we have that data. We need data on implementation, ideally, and we need data on outcomes. If we have those things, then we can do pretty strong observational research, taking advantage of those natural experiments to tell us whether the law worked or not. But in the meantime, we're also talking about who's exposed to the law. So, for example, we have a user on Law Atlas, the Seattle King County Health Department, and they used Law Atlas to track smoke-free park policies in their jurisdiction. And when they plotted all those policies, in addition to seeing, you know, which parks and which, you know, in which cities and unincorporated areas had these policies and which didn't, they also saw that there was a socioeconomic racial disparity, that the richer and whiter the community, the more likely it was to have a smoke-free policy, and the poorer and darker, the less likely. So right away, they could look at the map and have a work plan presented to them for improving the reach and distribution of health policy in your community, quite apart from doing any research. So I think you have the value of knowledge and data, and the many ways that you can use it once you have law in data form.
So does your signal pick up noise when you have interest groups, lobbyists who are sort of pushing the same sort of verbiage to several different states at once? Does that sort of hinder the variety of data that you're getting, and thereafter sort of the laboratory of the state's model?
There's a great example of this on our website, youth sports concussion laws. So today in 2015, every state has a law that regulates what should happen when a kid has a concussion in a school sport activity. What kind of consent and information has to be given to parents and participants before they participate? What coaches have to learn and do? All these have been passed since 2009, when Washington passed the first model. This Washington law was strongly supported by the NFL, and it was drafted, I think, with a lot of help and assistance from the NFL. And the same basic model was used in every state. So one of my colleagues at Temple, Hosea Harvey, has written about this and built this data set. And I think he's been very uncomfortable with that that form of controlled laboratory of the states and NFL process. I have taken a slightly different tack, which is I'm not so concerned that we have the same model. What I'm concerned about is that we test and see whether that model is actually effective and what we have to do to make it effective. You know, if we find it's not always necessary to have variation in the laboratory of the state, sometimes that's good. But the most important thing is when you get a policy model that really starts to spread, are we making sure it's a good one? You know, before you give somebody a drug, the FDA could make you spend billions of dollars to test it and then to do elaborate post-marketing follow-up. But we'll expose every kid in this country to the same law without any prior testing and, you know, with, I think, a pretty slow pace of evaluation once there's been implementation.
So, Scott, just to, since you sort of invited us to have a little bit more of a contestable or contesting attitude, I guess, sort of the beginning, I just had a couple of challenges there or thoughts about the project. One, the last metaphor you brought up, I teach administrative law, and the worry that I would have about that analogy is, you know, looking at things like the Regulatory Quality Act and other areas, it has been a bit of an argument by some more deregulatory forces to continually push for more information. And though, of course, you know, I recognize the OIRA and OMB policies demanding cost-benefit analysis and a reasoned consideration of outcomes, is there any concern that, you know, if that the metaphor you raised about the clinical research trial sort of model, that might lead to delays in policy implementation? Or could that be a good thing along the lines of pilot programs that demand evidence that something works before it's implemented?
Well, that's a great question, because the metaphor isn't quite perfect. I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's ludicrous to expect that you're going to get a better outcome by limiting innovation than you are by fostering innovation. So I think of the way we get safe and effective innovation and diffusion of what works this way. I mean, I think, first of all, although when we have a new idea and a new problem, we typically lack direct evidence for any particular response. We often have a lot of knowledge and analogous evidence that could guide us. You know, if you have a seatbelt law, and you know that a seatbelt law with primary enforcement has proven to cause greater compliance than a seatbelt law with secondary enforcement, then if you're now going to have a child safety seat law, you might plausibly take from that the idea that you should probably start with primary enforcement. And there's a lot of situations like that where we actually know more than we think, and we can innovate intelligently, and that could happen more. Likewise, I think we could use some of the techniques that are now coming out of the White House and out of the British government's, you know, offices for social and behavioral testing, where, you know, we can take some of the components or mechanisms of an intervention, of a legal intervention or regulatory intervention, and test that in a laboratory or in a small pilot to see if that mechanism works. But by and large, my strongest calling is for NIH and CDC and other funders of evaluation research in health to pay a lot more attention to what state legislators and city council people are doing, and to spend more money and spend it faster to evaluate legal interventions. We'll get the innovation, and then we'll also find out which model works and doesn't work.
Got it. No, I do see that. And I would love for you to sort of transition from that point to another issue that I know is very important to the team that you're leading, which is the alignment or lack of alignment between federal and state priorities. Any emerging trends there or any meta points about the value of that as a project, assessing that level of alignment?
I'm really thinking about that a lot now, and this is largely a chance to talk off the top of my head and see what you guys think. One thing that seems to be the case is that federal health recommenders, and so that's going to be what you see in, say, Healthy People 2020 or things that CDC put out, it's very important for them for a number of reasons, both cultural and political, to be evidence-based, right? So it's not completely 100% true, but generally speaking, you know, the most competent recommendations are things from the Community Guide, where they've got, you know, systematic reviews of many studies and a big evidence base that they can rely on to say it's a good idea to have, you know, smoke-free laws. By contrast, local legislators and state legislators are innovators. They're the ones who see the problems first, and they got to come up with a solution. So they almost never have an evidence base. Right. You know, by the time you know that a certain kind of law works, probably most states already have it. And when a lot of states don't have something, it's probably because there's no evidence guiding that. So they're on these different positions. That's why I think increasingly about this in terms of a dialogue where the federal health research establishment has to take lawmakers more seriously as people who are playing the same game they're playing. They're trying to come up with solutions to health problems, and taking them seriously means evaluating what they produce. Now, do we have some examples of that? Well, I mean, actually, the response to opioid overdose is a perfect example to that. Neither the states nor the federal government were really as aware as they should have been of the rising toll of prescription opioids in the mid-aughts. And it really wasn't until the late aughts and into this decade that you started to have serious federal consideration of this problem. And the states followed the same pattern. So the feds, you know, didn't have a lot of evidence-based solutions to offer. You know, they talked about prescription drug monitoring programs, pain clinic laws, you know, stricter enforcement, practice guidelines, all of which are, you know, plausible, but they just had very little to say. So that left states trying to figure this out substantially on their own. One of the things that swept the country, well, actually, there are two things that swept the country to deal with not so much overdose prevention, but death prevention. One was laws to make it legal or clearly legal for doctors to prescribe naloxone, which is the antidote for opioid overdose, to drug users and people using prescription opioids and members of their family and others who might be in a position to administer the drug to somebody who was having an overdose. And that's an idea that started in New Mexico in 2001 in terms of the law, when New Mexico was struggling with heroin on reservations, people overdosing in locations so far away from help that even though it might take 4 or 5 hours to die, they couldn't get EMT team there in time to administer the drug. So they started to give it out to people so they'd have it in situ. Well, that idea in the late aughts started to spread as a way to deal with the prescription opioid problem. And now more than half the states have passed those kinds of laws in the last couple of years. Similarly, there was a related law, Good Samaritan legislation, that simply promised that if people called 911 in an overdose to get help, they wouldn't be arrested when the police came for having drugs or for, you know, having drug paraphernalia. That too has spread very rapidly across virtually all regions of the country. Basically, the entire right half of the United States now has those laws from top to bottom, and they're pretty common on the left coast as well. But we have fairly limited evidence that they make a difference. To its credit, NIDA and CDC have made it a point to support some evaluation of these laws, and I think we'll learn more about that soon. And I think it's also fair to say that the Office of National Drug Control Policy came out pretty early in favor of trying those laws. But, you know, there's nothing on the federal level like the focus on those laws at the state level.
So is there a cost to doing business that way that maybe really comes quite close to questioning those really interesting benefits that you talk about? costs involve in the very sort of setup that you stated about state legislatures just kind of moving quickly without really an evidence base. And now I editorialize, often with somewhat suspect political agendas that move into state laws and perhaps cause major public health problems for many years before you get a mass of states doing the right thing.
Well, that's sort of the flip side of Frank's question, I think, right? You know, we don't want to slow down innovation, but boy, sometimes innovation is awful stupid and dangerous. And I guess I fall down on the side of thinking that the cost is worth the benefit of having them act. But I also am a realist, right? There's just try and stop those legislators. One of the things that we started to realize looking at doing policy surveillance over a wide range of areas and looking at the historical trends in health legislation, as we have in some of our papers, is that there's all this talk about, oh, no one likes the nanny state. Nobody likes, you know, the sort of, there's too much public health law, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, it seems like nothing is more popular among state legislators than passing health laws. We looked at a selection of health laws in the 2013 to 2015 session in the state legislatures across 8 or 9 topic areas, all the bills. You know, the overall rate of passage was 30%, you know, that's, or 20 to 30% anyway. So I'm just working on that paper, so I may have that wrong, but certainly much more than the average pass rate for a bill introduced into a legislature. The other thing that we see is if you understand this as a learning process, which, you know, may be a little naive, but if you step back and look over many years or decades, policy does seem in health law tends to trend towards the evidence-based line, so that there's tinkering and change, and things that are working start to spread, and things that are not working sort of fall into or are harmful tend to, you know, go down. Now, that's not uniform, and politics is always there, but there's just a whole lot of health law and health problem solving that really doesn't fall within big ideological battle zones, and where we kind of muddle through to a fairly decent result.
So, Scott, let's finish with another annoying sort of 50,000-foot question. We live in a world in which the clinical care and research Venn diagrams are overlapping more and more, in which translational medicine is huge. And who even knows how one should characterize an initiative such as the president's precision medicine plan? What about public health in this new world? I mean, I see from your programs, your work, the work of others, Charity Scott, Lindsay Wiley, and so on. We had Wendy Palmer on just a couple of shows ago. You seem to have succeeded in really increasing the footprint, the reach of public health law and how we understand it. But I wonder whether you could talk a little bit about public health. Is it becoming more clinical, less so? And if you like, what's the line between public health and population health?
That is a really good question. If the metric for good question is really, really hard and difficult to answer. There's a big hope in public health, at least in official public health, that there's going to be a stronger alignment between public health and clinical care. I think that doesn't reflect a belief that clinical care is going to have the magic bullets more and more and will be able to treat or prevent everything clinically. I think it has to do with the fact it seems like there's another chance to get at some of that clinical money in public health. So I don't take that. I take that in a history of public health agencies trying to find a way to get to that trough of money to do what they otherwise would continue to do. Now, you know, the community health needs assessment process, the whole IRS tax reporting for not-for-profit hospitals and so on. I mean, maybe that'll lead to sort of greater synergy. Let's hope so. The rise of the patient-centered medical home and more readily available primary care, if that really plays out, you know, maybe that'll help create a stronger synergy. But in other ways, public health and I treat public health and population health as different brand names for the same product. is moving in a, is maybe in a different direction. You know, we have been talking about social determinants and structural factors, the upstream, the deep drivers of health, the actual causes of disease for you know, several decades now. And the challenge is to figure out, how do you actually do something about that from a position within public health? The RWJF Culture of Health Initiative is in fact an effort to answer that question and to make some progress. So they have a careful, they've carefully developed this set of four action areas to improve population health. And only one of them is about clinical care. So in a certain way, that foundation, which is known for its work over many years to improve health care, has doubled down on non-clinical ways of changing our health picture. And a lot of it has to do with changing how people interact, levels of civic engagement, whether people are going to vote or not, whether they are demanding improvements in the environment and in the conditions of life from their politicians, whether we have equity, whether we're a segregated or integrated world, you know, country. These are the kinds of non-health questions that the social determinants approach asks us to address and find some way to change, and which are increasing, you know, even further from clinical care than traditional public health interventions. So, you know, we're going to continue to see this roil. And I think we're going to continue to have people point out that we really don't need to have a kind of line drawn between clinical care and public health. But, you know, fundamentally, you know, we've got to deal with the fact that health does not come from going to your doctor. It comes from where you're born, where you live, from the experiences and exposures you have in your daily life. And we've got to grapple with that and invest in that in an important way if we want to be as healthy as we can be, given all we know and all the resources we have.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Scott Burris for joining us. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, guys. It was a lot of fun.
We post our show notes at twill.com. Also at twill.com, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank, you can be found...
I am Frank Pasquale on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.